Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com, or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, how taking control of your finances is a form of self-care. I'll be joined by psychiatrist Dr. Jennifer Reid to talk about her new book, Guilt Free, and former GAA star Tony Griffin on what speaking to over 20,000 teenagers has taught him. So what kind of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, it has been a busy week. The kids were on midterm break. Our school gets the full week off. And usually I love the slower pace of mornings without the school run. But our new family member, the puppy, has kind of made it not work out that way. There have been night shifts for the toilet breaks and early starts. So I am remembering how it feels to have broken sleep. But I feel if I can survive two babies, I can definitely do a puppy. He is far less demanding and it's been going really well. I'd have to say he's settled really well into the family. It has been an adjustment, but we are all besotted and wondering how did we have life before him. And I've decided after this week that dogs are wellness. I did have Brendan Courtney tell me that on my What Keeps You Well series on my Instagram because he said his dog Nancy is definitely one of the things that keeps him well. And our dog, who we've named Mo, has taught me this week to just be really present. I have to say, over the last few days, I've been in the house more than I've been since we first moved in. I have been up early and then on the couch. I've been watching series on telly, hitting next, things I would never really allow myself. I'm always doing something or going here or going there or sorting something. And I've just really, really slowed down and I've absolutely loved it. There's been times where the kids might be taking over a shift in one room and I'll just go and sit in the other room and look out the window at the trees in the garden. And I have to say, I'm very grateful to Mo for slowing everything down. What I'm looking forward to next is when he's ready to go out for walks and is going to get us all out into the woods and out and about in nature. So yeah, dogs are wellness. And I must say thank you very much to all of you for emailing in your puppy tips. You can keep them coming, aliveandkicking at newstalk.com. Now, guilt can sneak into everything, work, relationships, parenting, even the moments when you're meant to be resting. For so many people, it's become the background noise of everyday life. Today, I'm talking about how to turn that volume down with Dr. Jennifer Reid, clinical psychiatrist and assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania, whose new book is called Guilt Free, Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. Jennifer, you're very welcome.
Claire, thank you so much for having me. I'm thrilled to be here.
And as a psychiatrist, this is something that you had heard over and over again, the same question from your clients. Why do I feel so guilty all the time?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I maybe didn't even hear them use the word guilt. They may not have even had that language. It may have just been, why do I always feel like I'm running behind? I'm not as organized as I should be. I'm just not enough. I'm not doing enough. And I think that's where I wanted to understand what is this feeling that so many women are experiencing?
And what do you think is feeding into it? Is it the way we have set up modern life that in many ways so much is achievable, but that's piling the pressure on us?
I do think that as our opportunities, I mean, many women have been trailblazers in pushing for more opportunities with careers and other experiences, that the expectations that we carry and that the culture, society sort of places on us really have not changed, have not updated all that well. And so when I was looking into some of those key expectations that women are socialized to feel from a very young age, they included things like being a constant caretaker, like taking care of everyone in our lives and in our different roles, and also being accountable for other people's emotions. Like, let's go try and make this the perfect party so that our friend will be happy, or let's plan something fun so our, you know, sister won't be disappointed that we couldn't make it to one of her events. Like, I think those, some of those expectations are really driving women to experience so much guilt.
And you do open the book by saying this book is for everyone. Guilt is genderless. But as you've just said there in your last answer, you really do focus on women because it was something you really felt was quite a female issue.
Well, I was just hearing it so commonly from the women in my practice and the women in my personal life, and was experiencing it myself. This sense of when I'm doing one thing in one role, I'm letting something else fall or slide, or I'm not doing my best in that role. I do think that certainly this occurs in everyone's life, and I hear it also in those who work maybe in healthcare or other sort of caring professions, teachers, counselors, that pressure to be caretakers. But I think young girls and then women are really uniquely under this pressure that this just would come naturally to us, that we should be constantly taking care of everyone.
So one of your chapters is entitled, Why Do Women Experience So Much Guilt? Can you tell us a little about the four furies of unreasonable expectations?
Absolutely. So when I really looked at how do I define guilt, how do I describe it so that we do have this language, I came up with these two variables for the guilt equation. One is our expectations, these four furies, which I will share. And the other side is, what's our perceived reality? What are we noticing that we're actually doing in our lives, which are many, many very positive things. And that I was hearing from patients as well. They were really discounting or not even noticing what they were contributing. So the four furies are these four main types of expectations. So the two I just mentioned, constant caretaking and this hyper accountability for other people's emotional experience, which we can't truly control. The other two are really this idea that we should be striving for perfection, really in everything, particularly self-control. What are we eating? What are we saying? What are we feeling? What are we drinking? What are we experiencing? How are we caring for others? And the final one is this sense that we need to have it all, that there are these opportunities and we should be able to take advantage of all of them and do it in a way that almost appears effortless, which of course is another impossible expectation.
Wow. When you're working in clinic, does shining a light on this make a difference? Or do people who are feeling stuck with guilt need to take steps to move away from that feeling?
Well, I think having the language for it, having something to call it, is really important, because not only is it helpful for our understanding of our own unique experience, it also helps us recognize that we are existing in this time and place, and so many other women are having this experience, that it creates the sense of community, that I'm not alone. I'm not like sitting over here by myself just getting it wrong while everyone else seems to be getting it right. I think having that community and me being able to, through the lens of working as a psychiatrist, I've spoken to so many women. I know how common this is. This is not a unique individual experience. And I think that's a really important starting point, so we can start working through and sort of shifting this really sticky feeling of guilt.
We have a relationships and intimacy coach who comes on the show regularly, and her last piece was talking about guilt and shame. And she really talked about the distinction between the two, and she described it that guilt is feeling you've done something wrong, where shame goes deeper, that there's something inherently wrong with you, which could obviously have such an impact on somebody to feel like they have to carry that. How does guilt show up in every day? You were saying that you would feel overwhelmed, that you're just not enough. But how else will it manifest that people might not be aware of?
Yeah, that's a great way. I mean, to differentiate between guilt and shame is important, because I agree. Guilt is a sense I'm not doing enough, or I'm doing the wrong things. But that can become almost constant and turn into a sense of shame, that my entire being is not worthwhile or is not valuable. So that's one of the really negative outcomes of so much guilt. Guilt shows up in our day-to-day in a lot of the language. The way that we speak to ourselves might be, I never get this right, or I can't believe I didn't follow through with what I was planning again, or I should be doing so much better, or I'm a bad mom because my child seemed sad today, or, you know, all these different ways that we're talking to ourselves and saying, what I am now is not enough, that I should be doing much more, or I should be doing it in a better way, a more, you know, perfect way. And I think that's where you're going to feel that showing up. And it may be that particular roles or particular dynamics trigger more guilt for you. You may feel more guilt at home, when you're leaving a child, say, to go to work, then you might feel in that workspace, or the opposite might be true. So I think it's starting to understand, where am I receiving the most triggers? Is it when I'm talking to my parents, for example, or is it when I'm interacting with my, you know, boss at work, to help us understand what are our unique triggers for this sort of universal feeling?
And you talk in the book about focusing on the action rather than the character. Talk to us a little bit about that, how we can distort that perception in our minds.
Right. And so this is where we broaden out what we perceive as a failure of, you know, we're not meeting these sort of unreasonably high expectations. And we're saying to ourselves, I'm just no good at all. I am just broadly not a worthwhile person. Again, shifting into that sense of shame, I think really pulling back. And I ask that of patients. I'll say, hey, you know, you're feeling guilty. Okay, I'm really, you know, I'm proud that you're able to describe that. Let's talk through what you did wrong. And I think when I do that, it's not uncommon for a woman to say, I don't know exactly, but I feel like I'm getting everything wrong, right? There's this really broad generalization of that feeling, as opposed to a more adaptive type of guilt that we all experience, which is, oh, you know what? I let my friend down in this specific way. I forgot that we were having lunch and we had to reschedule. And so now I'm feeling guilty about that. What am I going to do? I'm going to maybe apologize to that friend and we're going to reschedule. So there's a specific issue, a specific thing you may feel guilty about, and you have the opportunity to repair, or apologize, or move forward and learn about how not to do this again. That's very different than this sense of, I'm a bad mom because I can't do everything to make sure that my child is always happy.
Yeah, or, you know, the forgetting the friend's birthday that you mentioned, or the lunch, you know, you just forgot something because you're busy. You're not a bad friend. And it's just trying not to inflate it too far.
Exactly, because then it turns into this heavy criticism. And when you're being so hard on yourself, you know, we might try to use guilt as motivation. Like if I tell myself I'm the absolute worst, laziest person, maybe that'll get me to the gym. But that's really forcing yourself to start from behind and to start from this place of criticism. Like, I've already messed up and now I need to try and make it better. And it's very different from something like self-compassion, where it's, okay, I can be honest with myself. For example, I feel badly that I forgot my friend's, you know, this lunch or her birthday. That isn't aligned with the way I want to interact with my friendship. So I'm going to try and make a change. And that's a very sort of different scenario.
You also talk in the book about how we're going to have to accept that people are going to be disappointed in us. We are going to let people down from time to time. We're going to forget things. We're going to drop balls. We're not going to show up as our best selves. And that kind of plays into that perfectionism again, doesn't it? Because even as I'm saying that, I can feel something pulling inside of me. We don't want to let people down. Is that just a very natural way to be? Obviously that tribal mentality that to survive we want to be liked within our group.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right. I think that is hardwired. And I do talk about disappointment a lot because I think this is really, really important. It's truly impossible to avoid disappointing people. And really the only way to do that would be to live in total isolation, which of course we're not going to do. So the ability to see disappointment as just an emotional signal from something that happened in our environment or someone else's environment that isn't going to last forever. I think when we sort of catastrophize disappointment, or we think if I disappoint someone, that is incredibly damaging, they'll never forgive me, on and on and on, we're not allowing that emotion to just exist and then dissipate. Like, it really isn't so damaging. And I want to point out that it might be not even be that you did something wrong to disappoint someone. It might be that you made a decision that was best for you or best for your family, and that led to disappointment in someone else, which you can't control. And so I try to point out, you can be a very loving and wonderful person and still disappoint others. Like, that doesn't mean that you've actually done something wrong. And I think the more we can really get comfortable, or at least more comfortable with that, that's a really powerful change we can make.
How can we figure out if the expectations that we're setting for ourselves are realistic or fair?
Well, I think I use this a lot in my own life, is I'll have a guilty moment and I'll think to myself, what is the expectation here? And very often, not always, but very often it is that I would never XYZ. I would never say no to my son when he wants to play a game because I'm tired or I have something else I want to do. I would never, you know, take a day off from exercising because I just feel tired and need some rest. So I catch myself and I see, what is that expectation? And powerfully, what is shaping it? Who is shaping it? And I think the more aware you are of that, the more aware you can say, oh, this is a lot of pressure I'm receiving from my family members, for example, or from when I went online the other day and I was looking up, you know, how should a person be a good friend? And I was letting that define it for me. And so I think it allows you to see, are these expectations even achievable? Are they aligned with my values? Or do I actually want to start working to break them down and let them go?
So it really comes to that self-awareness, doesn't it? It's like you said, it even happens to you. You know, you're working in this every day. You're a university professor of psychiatry. You're in clinic. So you've researched and written for this book, and yet guilt still comes and finds its way to you. So we can't avoid it, but it's about catching it and not letting it take over.
Exactly, that I'm sort of living in this time and place where these expectations are very present for women, and that the infrastructure doesn't necessarily support the increase in opportunities that we have. So the important thing is not, I will never ever feel guilty, but to recognize it and not let it into the driver's seat. I think that's really where we can get into trouble. Oh, I feel guilty that I said no to that activity with my parents. So then I quickly wanted to take away their disappointment. I told them I could come the next weekend, even though I really can't do that. So we find that we're making decisions based on what we think we should do, or with this sort of attempt to control someone else's emotions. And that can really lead to disappointment, to guilt, and to us just feeling like we're getting everything wrong.
You mentioned that word control, which I think is interesting, and something that's often said about women is that sometimes we need to relinquish control a little bit because there's so much mental load with all of the things you mentioned, thinking of the parents, the colleagues, the friends, the birthday parties, the kids, and really carrying all other people's emotions along with our own. Is it important that we begin to let go of things a little bit and, you know, let somebody else organize X, Y, Z, or have those boundaries and just say, no, that doesn't suit me right now?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's why I talk about both boundaries and the art of delegation in the book, because I see boundaries not as a wall we're putting up between ourselves and others, but rather that sort of support structure that allows us to safely and lovingly engage with them. It creates the safe space where I know that you're going to hopefully recognize my boundaries and take, you know, what I'm able to give you here, as opposed to saying I need more and more and more. So I think boundaries that are consistent, you may need to edit them as time goes, or maybe different times of your life where different boundaries might need a bit of tweaking, but to be aware of what they are and consistently communicating them. And then also the art of delegation, the ability to say, I am a strong and wise person because I know how to ask for help, I know how to reach out, I know how to gather people to help me. I think, as opposed to this narrative we might carry with us that I have to be superwoman, and any asking for help means I've failed, or means I'm letting people down, or I'm not good enough.
Well, it's a message I always love to share. It always makes me feel sad when I hear, you know, women are apologizing for themselves, for how they look, you know, how they're showing up in the world, feeling guilty because they ate a piece of cake, and everything that you've spoken about so far. Let's try put down the guilt and replace it with a little more self-compassion. The book is called Guilt Free, Reclaiming Your Life from Unreasonable Expectations. Dr. Jennifer Reid, thank you so much for coming on.
Claire, thank you for having me.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking
on News Talk.
Now, money can be a huge source of stress, but what if we started thinking about it as self-care? Small, practical steps that actually bring peace of mind, from pensions and insurance to debt and day-to-day decisions. I'm joined by Nick Charalambos, Managing Director of Alpha Wealth. Nick, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Claire.
So what are some of these steps around financial self-care? It's worth reviewing how we're spending our money. And you suggest we start with looking at our pension and either getting one or reviewing the one we already have.
Absolutely. I suppose, Claire, when I look at pensions, and I know it's not probably the most exciting topic for people to kind of think about, I would always just put it into that sort of long-term category of that last third of our lives that we want to try and enjoy ourselves and have the financial freedom to do so. And the reason why my industry talks about pensions a lot is that they carry two really big advantages. One is that you get this tax back from the government, and depending on how much you earn, it's either at 20% or at 40%. If you're earning over $44,000 a year, it's at 40%. The other thing is that the money grows tax-free in that pot. So it does make sense for people to put a certain percentage of their income, however small, into that long-term kind of, you know, security blanket, if you like, that allows them to have more choices, even if it's a case of trying to retire a year or two early.
And if somebody doesn't have a pension, how do they go about it? What should they be looking for?
Well, the new government pension scheme called Auto Enrollment obviously brought about 700 or so thousand people into that pension net as of the start of this year. But there are still those, particularly self-employed people, who weren't included in that. And there may be those that are perhaps aren't quite earning enough or may not be in the right age category. It typically affected people between 23 and 60 that earn over 20,000 a year. For anyone who doesn't have a pension scheme, the key things to note are that, firstly, you have to be employed. So it only really makes sense for those who are in the tax net. But more so is that, like any financial product or anything for that matter that you do buy, make sure that you're getting independent advice. You know, those people who may talk to a financial broker, for example, who may be tied, I don't know if that's the ideal scenario. You want to be able to have the full scope of the market. It does boil down to fees and being able to try and kind of understand what the fees are that you pay and being able to compare them, which, again, I appreciate might not be straightforward for everybody. But sometimes even by, you know, asking two different individuals what their fees are will help you kind of assess. And I do think sometimes that's a kind of a good model for people to follow. Obviously, we try and kind of follow things. There's a lot more information available to us through the likes of ChatGPT and social media. I wouldn't take everything that's on those as gospel, but sometimes it can be a good kind of start. And there's some very good, I suppose, financial authors that people can get a little bit of guidance on and help them in terms of making kind of these what are generally quite big decisions.
And often people will have set one up and then just leave it. They're like, I've got that box ticked. I have a pension. Is it something you need to review?
It is, Claire. And it's one of the things that I would stress really, really a lot with any of your listeners, that your financial plans, and again, we're talking about the long term with pensions, but that implies to short term for any kind of financial goals that we have. And by short term, anything kind of less than 3 years. And then medium term fits in kind of that category in between those two. They need to be assessed, in my opinion, at least once a year. The reason is that things change. You know, we sometimes go through different stages of life. You know, it could be getting a different job or losing our job or getting a pay rise. Or indeed, where we might have, you know, an addition to our family, and you just have to reassess those three different parts and make sure that you're applying the right amount to each of them. It's almost like these dials that I refer to, that they just need to be adjusted. And once a year, I think, is a really good kind of, I suppose, starting point to think about when you do those. Or indeed, if there's a particular life event as well, of course.
Insurance is another area you think we should constantly review, checking our providers. Can we be paying too much for insurance?
I definitely think so, Claire. And whilst my industry generally tends to kind of, I suppose, recommend insurances such as life assurance and illness cover or protecting your income, which are all very important, again, depending on your situation. But there is always a fear that sometimes these things are not reviewed frequently enough. For example, there may be people who may have taken out mortgage protection, which is a policy that's forced upon us when we borrow money from a bank. But if we've paid off the mortgage, or if we paid off a large amount of that, we may not necessarily need the same level of cover. Or indeed, there may be those people who have benefits through their employment, where they may have taken out a policy because they were provided it maybe before they got that particular opportunity through their job, or indeed that they are paying too much for a specific policy. And interestingly, life assurance rates, which includes mortgage protection, have actually fallen in the last 10 years because as a nation, we tend to live a bit longer now than we used to. So it's actually cheaper, believe it or not, to buy a policy today than it would have been 5 or 10 years ago. And this is why reviewing them with someone that is arguably impartial would potentially help you save money on not just that, but also other insurances. Health insurance is a huge one as well, Claire. It's a very expensive cost that has been going up considerably. But there's so many different plans available, and unfortunately, people don't necessarily get appropriate advice to understand what plans they should be on and making sure that they're paying the least amount possible.
And it's a small win, isn't it? As I said in the introduction, money can cause us so much stress and worry in our lives. But if we sit down and look at everything from our utility providers or our insurance and try and save ourselves small bits of money, I just think it dials down that sense that we don't have control and there's so much we can't control. But by taking a look at it and celebrating those little small wins, it can start to ease off that anxiety.
I agree, Claire. And I know, again, that unfortunately, we've got so many different, I suppose, decisions that we have to make. And when it comes to things like insurances, as you said, they tend to come at a time where maybe we don't have the ability to be able to kind of ring around and, you know, shop for a cheaper policy. And it tends to happen, you know, for things like car insurance or indeed, as I mentioned, health insurance. And we just kind of like auto-renew. And the point being is that I'm not asking your listeners to kind of ring around 10 different insurance providers. Personally speaking, I would never do that. I wouldn't have the time or indeed the energy. But making sure that you at least have one general insurance broker that can give you a proper quotation for, say, your car insurance renewal, where they do the work for you. And yes, they will be remunerated, but it won't necessarily cost you any more because the fact is that, like most insurances, they get paid by the policy provider that they place that business with. And it can work out well financially, both for you and for that particular broker. And if you take that analogy and say to yourself, okay, well, I know that whenever I get this renewal, I need to give it to somebody else that can do that for me. If it relates to obviously personal finance, it might be a financial advisor, like someone like myself, who a lot of people think that you have to have a lot of money to engage with. And that's really the furthest thing from the truth. We speak to a lot of people often who are maybe struggling a little bit in terms of, you know, this cost of living rise that we've witnessed over the last few years and how to save money in a lot of different areas that can add up to quite a large amount when you collectively take it all into account.
What about paying back of debts? And that can be at varying degrees for people. What is your advice there on how we can manage that better?
So debt can be, again, something that can affect us, obviously. The fact of the matter is that, yeah, there are occasions where we must take out debt, Claire. For example, mortgages. It's very difficult for many people to buy a property without taking out, obviously, a mortgage loan. That tends to be what I would classify as good debt. The rates tend to be quite low, and the reality is that it's almost impossible to do it without taking out that particular loan. However, there are what I classify as being bad types of debt. Typically, credit card debt would fall into that category. And I totally recognize and understand why people might use their credit card. I've been guilty of that in the past, where, you know, I may have wanted to buy an item that I didn't have the money for at that very moment, maybe buying a holiday for the family. And the key point, though, is that we need to kind of understand that you need to apply attention to getting that paid off as soon as possible if you do have that. So what I would say to your listeners is that they might have like a short-term loan, they might have a car loan, they may have a mortgage, and they may have a credit card bill. And whilst, you know, you just need to kind of recognize and firstly understand the different types of debt, is about how you're going to tackle that. And my philosophy, and I use a rule, I call it snowballing, where you try and pay off the smallest amount first, and then you move that attention up to the next larger amount, and so on and so forth, hence the snowball. The reason being is that the smallest amount of debt tends to be the most expensive, and it is the one that you can probably tackle easiest. So, for example, if you owed 1,000 euros on a credit card, Claire, and say owed 10,000 on a car loan, my suggestion would be that you focus on paying off the credit card first. It tends to be the highest interest one. And once that's paid off, you reapply the money that you were using to pay back that loan onto the next one, and so on and so forth. Typically, for most of your listeners, the mortgage would be the one that I'd leave to the very last, because it tends to be the cheapest.
And if you get to a point where you have paid off that credit card, that car loan, and you're only left with the mortgage, do you need to give that money that was a repayment a better job?
Absolutely. And we do suggest, Claire, that, again, without getting really technical, and I have some clients who don't like the idea of budgeting and thinking about their finances that forensically. And it's not something that I personally do myself. I have my money in different pots, as I described earlier. But that, yes, when I am in a better financial position, for example, if I have a loan paid off, I need to reapply that to somewhere else. It could be savings. It could be towards my pension. It could be that it allows me to sort of pay towards a holiday or something that I may be looking to do in the shorter term. And as long as we've kind of started to think a little bit about what our financial objectives are, I think that'll help us to kind of manage, because it can be difficult. And I totally understand, you know, I have four children in a blended family, that we've got a lot of things that kind of hit us, and it's just not being, you know, maybe prepared when those things occur. And that's probably why we do go on then to taking out debts that may not necessarily have been, you know, what we had planned for.
Well, Nick Sharalambas, Managing Director of Alpha Wealth, thank you very much for coming on.
Thank you so much again, Claire.
Alive and kicking on News Talk. Alive and kicking on News Talk.
Now, teenage years often include big emotions, big pressure, and a world that expects them to have it all figured out. So today we're talking about guiding teenagers towards self-acceptance and confidence with someone who's listened to over 20,000 young voices along the way. Former GAA star Tony Griffin, author of The Teenager's Book of Life, is joining me on the line now. Tony, you're very welcome.
Hi, Claire. Thank you.
So you've listened to a whole host of teenagers. Why did you want to do that?
I suppose whatever you do, very often when it comes to working with other people, it comes from something you needed yourself. And I suppose as a teenager, I was the kind of guy who looked like he had it all figured out on the outside, but inside felt very low in confidence, unworthy, gangly in his body, and often thought he was the only one that felt that way. And then just throughout my life, I was certain experiences, my own ups and downs, brought me to question, how do we prepare young people for real life, not necessarily for academic life? And I looked around the world for someone who was doing something. This is 2011, global financial crisis times. Came across an Irishman called Jim Steins down in Melbourne, sold my car, went down, studied what Jim was doing with teenagers. It was very evolved, and we brought it back to Ireland and called it SOAR, as in to take off or to glide. And all of a sudden it was like a tsunami of demand from schools to come and run these workshops. So I had the privilege really of every week listening to hundreds a week talk about their lives and the lives they were living behind the masks they felt they had to put on to fit in. And so after 9 years, one day I just said, we had two small boys, and I said, I'm going to write what I've learned before I forget it. And 6 weeks later, The Teenager's Book of Life was done.
And what were some of the things you heard from teenagers time and time again?
The biggest one is really what all of us adults feel. There's a question about, who am I? Where do I belong? Am I enough? Am I good looking enough? You know, am I capable enough? Comparison. And then all the other things that go on in life, like very often things like divorce and family breakdown, just the whole range of issues. A big one was grief. That's why we added a chapter this year to the book on grief, because so many teenagers say their first brush with losing a loved one is that grandparent that they could talk to, who was, you know, who was good fun, who didn't tell them they couldn't do this or that. And that was a big part of it. And very often it was just, wanting to be liked by others and understood and feeling like they were the only one in the world that was going through what they were going through, because they felt it was a weakness to talk about it or to even show other parts of themselves that weren't the ideal perfect part.
You were saying about your own experience as a teenager, and I think, you know, listeners will be thinking back to the challenges of their own teenage years. Are teenagers today under more pressure than previous generations?
You know, every generation has greater challenges than the one before, and that's because of the changes in how we live socially very often. But I think the problem, like when I was a kid, my refuge was, I was big into hurling, was the hurling pitch. And I felt different when I was on a hurling pitch. I felt like I was valuable. But also, like, ups and downs. I remember, you know, being punched at a teenage disco because I kissed someone else's girlfriend and I didn't know. You know, I went home that night and that guy never really bothered me again because he went to a different school. Whereas the big difference, and we know this, is how young people and their lives depend so much on being connected to the virtual world. And in that virtual world, a world that a lot of parents don't fully understand to the same extent, it is even harder for them to define their own sense of who they are, because they're being bombarded about with who they should be and who they need to be. And that's a really hard thing for a teenager in that phase, because Claire, in that phase, our brains are changing in so many ways, and we're changing in a way that we're looking for our tribe or where to belong. And that's where places like the Netflix series Adolescence showed us. It's a new world, and that's where personal connection, like if you say to a lot of adults or parents, a lot of teenagers have lost the social skills to look you in the eye, speak to you, because they don't necessarily need to usually. They can just go onto their phone. So that's why I wanted to write the book, is to help them understand who they are beyond who they feel they should be to fit in.
And it's the age of distraction, isn't it? That constant stream of entertainment, be it on the TV or on the phone, it doesn't give much time for self-reflection. I'm not sure how self-reflective I was in my teens, but there was certainly more time to be self-reflective when the three shows I watched weren't on anymore and I was just sitting in my room.
There was less distraction. So a lot of the book is about how do we befriend and, you know, name it, tame it, our feelings. Most of us, unknowingly, unconsciously, we're running away from ourselves, or the feelings we have about certain things, our anxiety about the little and, you know, the big A and the small A. And so it's so easy now for young people to become distracted, or to be distracted away from how they feel, how they really feel deep down. But those things don't go away. They come up again and again. And very often, you know, when you're in the swimming pool and you're pushing down the beach ball, the more you push it down, the further and higher it comes up. And that's where I think we really need to look at creating space for young people to just sit and be and talk to each other, to understand, because that's what they'll do most of all. Rather than sit in their room necessarily, they'll and that's what we learned with SOAR. When they're together, we had 50, 100 in a class, and they would blow each other's minds by, you mean that's what your life is really like? But that's not what you put online. And then they feel like they have more permission to be themselves, or they're more authentic, they're less perfect self, their rawness.
What do you think of the secondary school system? Is it serving our teenagers in the way it should? And I say that with the greatest of respect for people working within it as well, because look, you've said there were schools up and down the country who welcomed you in with open arms. You know, it's not that there is a hesitancy around this in all schools, but is it serving teenagers in finding out who they are and making space like this for them?
Well, I, like you, have huge respect. I know many teachers who perhaps are listening to this, and they go above and beyond. And I met many teachers who would have got SOAR in when SOAR was a controversial thing, because we were letting teenagers cry. We were letting them, if that's what they want to do, or rage, or want to pick up the chair and throw it across the room. It was all valid. And so many schools were very progressive and let us do that. I think what isn't serving young people is the structure and the container that our secondary schools are. We've great facilities, we've great teachers. We are starting to look at a well-being curriculum and bring in the SPHE. But if most, and this could be controversial, but most of our preparation of teachers aren't teaching them about the psychology or the what is required to understand within themselves. Like, you can only teach what you've understood yourself experientially. It's one thing cognitively, logically, but it's another thing to know what that feels like. And so I think we could really benefit from reimagining the purpose of our education system. I think we're lost in that. We're preparing them for a world that they necessarily aren't fully prepared for on the inside. And our rates of, this isn't my opinion, the rates of research and data around, you know, anxiety in 20-year-olds, self-harm, all, it's all there. It's speaking to us. And it's for us to now take a step back. The challenge is, it's like trying to move a tanker with a toothpick. The school system is so large and ingrained that what I think you're going to start seeing more and more of, Claire, and we saw it 10 years ago, but it's gathered pace, are these young people who opt out of school, that they just stop going. And I know that's on the rise anecdotally from talking to teachers. And I think you're going to see more of that until we do move that tanker in the direction that young people need it to be going.
So how do we manage this book? I'm just conscious it can be difficult sometimes as the parent of teenagers or the caregivers to give advice in the right way that's met with open arms. I'm thinking of a book I have at home on relationships and consent, and both my kids have a teen and a tween, and it's met with a bit of an eye roll. So how do we manage how we communicate with our teens?
So I always say to parents, this is like the Trojan horse so into Tara. You don't give it to them. Even if you buy it for them, you leave it somewhere. How you relate, and you know this yourself, how you relate to them as little kids has changed now. It's a brand new field of play. And understand what it's like to be them, because they respond to that level of honesty. It's hard for parents to do that. So I always say to them, it's reconnected with your own teenage self. And then it's not necessarily what you say to your teenager. It's where it's coming from. It's coming from a place in you that you are understanding them. You're validating how they feel because you can reconnect to how it felt for you.
Yeah, I really agree with you. And I've really found the most effective communication I've had in my own house has been, you can level with them. I mean, yes, okay, we're still in charge, but we don't have to be a big authority over them. You can really level with them and listen. Sometimes just sit and listen to what they have to say. I think it's fabulous, the work that you're doing, Tony. I hope that we get to cross paths again in some way. The book is called The Teenager's Book of Life. You can find out more about Tony's work at tonygriffin.ie. Tony, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
So that's it for Alive and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Maurice O'Sullivan, to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound. Rory Galvin was on podcasts. And thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.